From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now. French President Emmanuel Macron capped off the first official state visit of the Trump administration with an address this morning to both houses of Congress. Macron joked about how many kisses he and President Trump exchanged in public events this week, but then he took issue with much of the Trump go-it-alone world agenda, speaking most passionately about climate change, about which Trump is skeptical.
By polluting the oceans, not mitigating CO2 emissions, and destroying our biodiversity, we are killing our planet. Let us face it, there is no planet B.
Macron and First Ladies Brigitte and Melania Trump brought a dollop of excitement to Washington with an elegant state dinner last night. But elsewhere in the political netherworld, it's not so pretty. White House physician Dr. Ronnie Jackson, President Trump's pick to be Veterans Affairs Director, accused of drinking and mistreating staff. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt under fire for spending and cozying with lobbyists. Let's bring in our political strategist. What would they advise? Joining us this week, Karine Jean-Pierre, the Democrat who worked in the Obama White House. Hi, Karine.
Hi.
And Paris Dinard, the Republican who worked in the George W. Bush White House and is on a White House Advisory Commission. Paris, welcome as well.
Hello.
And the Republican head of the committee considering Ronnie Jackson's nomination, Johnny Isaacson, reportedly expressed concern about Jackson. On ATC here on NPR yesterday, Montana Senator John Tester, the ranking Democrat of the Veterans Affairs Committee, went into detail. Let's listen.
Improper dispensing of prescription drugs. Repeatedly drunk while on duty, while traveling, and creating a toxic work environment.
Now, Jackson's denying all of this, but Paris, we're going to start with you. Republicans are worried. Maine Senator Susan Collins said the White House is feeling its way on the nomination process, doesn't do vetting. South Dakota Senator John Thune saying the same thing. Trump is blaming problems with nominees on Democrats. But yesterday he seemed to give Jackson an out, you know, kind of don't do it. Today's double down. Would you advise him to let this nomination go? These accusations are bad.
You know, I appreciate the question. And no, I would advise President Trump to stand firm on his nomination, because what this articulates, or what this highlights, I should say, is the way we have become in the political environment that we're in. It is funny how Dr. Jackson was a celebrated admiral, celebrated in his role as physician, one of the closest people to the president, the ability to keep the president alive, the ability to actually, you know, harm the president if they're not up to par. And he did that faithfully in a great way for President Obama. He comes to being President Trump's doctor, gives a glowing report about the president's mental health and his physical health, much to the dismay of a lot of people on the left. And then the president nominates him to be the head of the VA and then open the floodgates. Now we have a problem with him. Now he can't be trusted. Now all of these issues that should have been raised in the Obama administration. But if they were raised, they were passed aside as not being credible or not being factual or not being worth noticing. So I think it's part of the political nature
that we're in.
Let me ask Karine.
Karine, are Democrats at some fault here, maybe hypocritical and critical and criticizing him now, but everybody, you know, kind of liked him before?
No, I think that's so ridiculous. The first thing is that President Obama did not nominate his personal doctor to be the head of Veterans Affairs, which is the second largest agency behind the Department of Defense. It has a $200 billion budget, it has hundreds of thousands of people that he would have to manage. He's just not qualified. Put aside all of this allegations that we're hearing. This guy is just not qualified. He should have never been put forth for this job. And you know what? It's weird. I mean, Donald Trump needs to do his job. His administration needs to do their job. I vet my dog walker better than Trump administration vets their nominees to run our government. And this is somebody, Donald Trump, is somebody who promised the best. Instead, we have the most corrupt and unqualified cabinet in history. It's not just Jackson. There's a whole list of people in the Trump administration that is incredibly questionable with ethics and with qualification. And I just don't understand what's going on.
Well, moving on to some of the other folks in the administration who are having some trouble. On NPR's Morning Edition today, White House spokesman Hogan Gidley was asked if President Trump still wants EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt to stay on the job, despite a whole bunch of questions, including that Pruitt sought special treatment for himself and is too close to oil and gas lobbyists. And spokesman Gidley didn't give a full-blown endorsement.
I can tell you that the president and the White House are aware of these issues and these stories
they raise some serious concerns. There's no question about that. We're looking into those issues and concerns as well. And the EPA, quite frankly, and Mr. Pruitt are going to have to answer those questions in short order.
Paris, it seems even Pruitt's Republican supporters may have had enough. What are you hearing?
Yeah, a lot of people are concerned about the constant drip, drip, drip of the allegations and the former people that worked for him coming out and saying this and that, and you have to question why that they're doing it now and all that things. But at the end of the day, Hogan's right. You have to put this back on the EPA administrator, and he's going to have to answer all of those questions if the Congress has them or if the president has them. But ultimately, the president every president deserves to have the cabinet that he wants. So if the president wants to have those persons in there, they should be allowed to put together the government that they want. It's called the consequences of every election. That goes as well for the Supreme Court nominees. And so what you have here is the president still having faith in Pruitt's ability to lead the agency and to carry out the mission and the agenda and the viewpoint of how EPA should be run under the Trump administration. And in President Trump's mind and a lot of Republicans' minds, he's doing a good job at that.
Karine, to you, does this underscore wider problems?
Yes, it absolutely does. Look, I'll agree with Paris. Every president should have the cabinet secretaries that they want, the cabinet that they want to represent their platform and what they want to move forward. The problem is Donald Trump and his administration, his White House, are not vetting folks. They're not putting people put forth that are actually qualified to do the job. If anything, the people that they put forth do the opposite. They're known for having the opposite ideas of what the agency stands for. Look, in no other administration, Democrat or Republican, the Bush, the Clinton, the Obama administration, would Pruitt still have a job? He has abused his power and our money in every way imaginable, in ways that are truly unimaginable.
Well, but
it's a long time that he needs to go.
But as Paris said, he's also rolled back tons of regulations. I mean, they want him there. But I want to move on to something else, because there was a remarkable moment Monday night when Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Bob Corker of Tennessee got emotional, cried, because the Democrat Chris Coons of Delaware voted president instead of no on the nomination for Mike Pompeo to be Secretary of State to help a Republican colleague to vote after getting back from a funeral. Here's Corker responding to that.
I in particular want to thank Senator Coons for displaying the statesmanship that I've been accustomed to seeing in the Senate.
You know, Karine, what a moment. And it got me thinking, we never see Democrats because there's so much news around the Republicans right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is a way for them to sort of, you know, have some face time in Washington, do unexpected nice things. I mean, this is unbelievable that a civil moment in Washington is making headlines. We have so few of them.
Right, because we're so we're just so partisan on each side, and this is kind of the political atmosphere that we're living in. Look, I know Senator Chris Coons, and he's a good guy. It actually is not surprising that he did that to me. He is a statesman, as Corker has mentioned, and it's nice to see. I do not agree with Pompeo's nomination or anything that Pompeo stands for, but I'm glad that Chris Coons was able to do something that shows that there can be some niceness, you know, some bipartisanship on the Hill.
Well, let's look at Macron and Trump. Before Congress today, mm-hmm. French President Emmanuel Macron urged Trump not to withdraw from the international agreement reining in Iran's nuclear program. Big debate over that. Passionately defended multilateralism instead of isolationism. And he criticized those who fan fear and anger.
You can play with fears and angers for a time, but they do not construct anything.
Karine, what do you think? Was this a mistake to sort of switch in tone from bromance of last night and yesterday to this thinly veiled criticism of the president?
No, I mean, I think Macron is there to, he has his people too to worry about. He has to go home and to deal with the folks that are there. So it's not surprising. I think he's playing this very, very well. He's he clearly took the a master's course in how to manage Donald Trump, and he's done I think a magnificent job on
the Trump whisperer.
Is Trump whisperer, right? And he's been doing that for a year. It's not at all new. He's been doing that for several months and trying to, you know, speak to Trump in a way that Trump listens and hears, which is speaking, you know, tapping into Trump's insecurities. And so it's not at all surprising. Well, and then you'll have Merkel who's going to be coming in a day or two.
Paris, yeah, only have a minute. Jump in, yeah.
Sure. I think this was a tremendous week for the president and for the first lady. I thought what you saw with the relationship between President Macron and President Trump, we haven't seen since Reagan and Thatcher. And I think the good thing about this is that it's good for the American people and the world to see world leaders coming together and wanting to work together to solve some of the tough problems and tough issues of this nation. So I think the president and the administration should be feeling really good about international affairs and politically. Look, Arizona 8 was a big win last night for Republicans, and we won six out of seven competitive special elections.
You said it's a big win.
It's a win is a win.
By 5 points.
I win, and it's a win. And it's a win.
It's an election. Republicans should have won by double digits. They should have won by 25 points.
Oh, we didn't even get to talk about Melania's hat or the dandruff on the shoulder. Paris Denard, the Republican strategist, Green Jean-Pierre, the Democrat. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Hulu's drama series The Handmaid's Tale debuts its second season today. The first season set a pretty high bar. It won a Peabody and 8 Emmy Awards, including one for Outstanding Drama Series. It ended where Margaret Atwood's source novel also ended. So this season, the show's writers are pretty much on their own. NPR TV critic Eric Deggan says the new episodes reach beyond Atwood's original story in surprising and complex ways.
Watching The Handmaid's Tale can sometimes feel like an endurance test. Consider an early scene from the second season, which features handmaids, women forced into sexual slavery as breeders by a theocratic government called Gilead. They're each made to hold a rock at arm's length in the rain for hours as punishment. Their tormentor and supervisor, Aunt Lydia, played by Emmy winner Ann Dowd, explains how this actually gives them freedom.
Girls, there is more than one kind of freedom! There is freedom to and freedom from. In the days of anarchy, it was freedom to. Now you are being given freedom from. That is a gift from God.
Freedom is a major theme in the second season of The Handmaid's Tale as the story moves beyond the classic book. The pregnant handmaid June, played by Elizabeth Moss, thought she found a bit of freedom last season when she inspired her fellow handmaids to refuse Lydia's orders to stone a friend to death. But Lydia explains just how wrong June is and the collateral damage she's caused.
She could have gone to God quickly, surrounded by her friends.
Friends don't stone their friends to death.
Janine is on her way to the colonies. She will suffer because of you. Every handmaid who followed you into disobedience will face the consequences. But not you. You are with child. You are protected. Such a brave girl, aren't you? Standing in defiance, but risking nothing.
The Handmaid's Tale succeeds by building a fictional world that is both nightmarishly brutal and convincingly authentic. In the second season, that world expands. We see the colonies, vast radioactive wastelands where women who don't submit are sent to shovel poisonous dirt until they die. And we see how people lived before the theocracy took control. They didn't react as rights were slowly rolled back for women and gay people, like frogs sitting in a pot of slowly boiling water, until it was too late. Gilmore Girls alum Alexis Bledel, who also won an Emmy Award last year for her work on the show, plays a handmaid named Of Glenn, sent to the colonies. This season, we also see her pre-Gilead life as Emily, a college professor who is told by her boss she can't teach classes because she's openly gay.
But I'm not going to hide my family.
Look, things are unstable. People are afraid. I took all the pictures of Paul from my office.
I noticed. I thought you guys had a fight.
We did. He says I'm a collaborator.
They can't scare us back into the closet.
But they do even worse. There are two obvious messages here. The time when it's necessary to stand up for your freedom might be sooner than you think. And even in the worst nightmares, life and love persist. And at a time when real-life neo-Nazis are burning swastikas at rallies in Georgia, this dystopia seems frighteningly possible. Tough as it is to watch this show sometimes, these scenes hold lessons for responding to today's turbulent times, which is the best reason to return to one of the finest dramas on television as it takes flight in its second season. I'm Eric Deggans.
I think we could declare that spring has arrived. How about getting some of it on our plates? Resident chef Kathy Gunst is here. Kathy, you are bringing in the greens?
It's a pretty exciting moment. I've said this in the past, but I do always think of that moment in The Wizard of Oz when it goes from black and white to color. That is how it feels, particularly in New England after a very, very long winter. We're talking about chives, arugula, peas, artichokes, watercress, even dandelion greens.
Dandelion greens. These are the things that you try to kill when they're in your lawn.
Absolutely.
Or you eat them.
You do eat them, but you only eat them if you have the kind of lawn that I have where no chemical has ever touched it. The most harmful thing to touch my lawn is a lawnmower. it has to be an area of land that you are 110% sure has never been sprayed. Otherwise, you find dandelion greens this time of year at farmers markets. I found it in my regular old supermarket, and it's an elongated green. The dandelion, you can eat the dandelion flowers and the greens. They're earthy, they're nutty, and they're also slightly bitter, almost like an arugula or a radicchio. It's the long, long elongated green.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at it now. It's so beautiful. And then when you see the elongated green coming out of
your
lawn,
you're like, oh no, I got to mow. So before you mow, pick and eat or look for them at a farmer's market. They're, like so many of these spring greens, so good for you. Like no calories, tons of vitamins, and very high in calcium.
Okay, so that's the dandelion green. And we've got a salad here. We'll have all these pictures at herenow.org. I can see the radishes sliced up. I can see the dandelion greens. What else am I seeing?
So I call this the green, green spring salad because we must be redundant because we finally have green. This is a very, it's almost like a tonic to winter. This is parsley, fresh mint, fresh chives, fresh dill, a little bit of thinly sliced radishes. You can throw your dandelion greens in there. And then to keep it light and keep it fresh, the vinaigrette is made with lemon juice and chives and olive oil. This salad, ready?
Mm-hmm.
5 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, no exaggeration. You could have that for lunch with a piece of grilled bread with olive oil on it, and that would be a lovely celebration of spring.
Of course, there might be 5 more minutes out on the lawn with that little pokey thing, getting the roots of the dandelion, because if you don't get the roots, then you haven't really got it out.
All I can think of are those commercials for spring where they're like, hate those dandelions? Put this poison on your lawn.
And you're like, no.
No. Go organic. Go
eat
green.
Eat it. Okay, it makes you feel like you're doing something good for yourself, but it also is such a, I mean, it's like a wake-up call for yourself. This is also the beginning of the season for pesto, and you've got toast and pesto, but what kind is this?
This is an arugula pesto. It has no basil in it. Pesto can be made with so many things, and this time of year, the arugula is one of the first greens you'll see in many gardens and farmers markets. Very tender, slightly bitter. When I say bitter, I mean in a really pleasing way. Mm-hmm. There's bitter that's like, no, I don't want that, and then there's bitter that you actually really crave and like.
It looks just like, you know, basil. Old pesto, but let's see.
Got a really different taste, and hopefully, you get the crunch of just some grilled French bread with olive oil on it. Arugula is, again, low in calories, 8 calories for 2 cups. It is filled with vitamins A, K, and C, iron, potassium, calcium, full of antioxidants. I swear if you eat a lot of this arugula pesto, you'll live to 100.
Wow. It's a very different taste.
Isn't it? It's completely different. You can't be expecting the basil. But on a piece of salmon, if you spread that on it and put it on your grill this spring, or even popped it into a hot oven or a skillet, it would be great on a piece of chicken, but it's equally good just on a piece of toast.
Wonderful.
With a salad for dinner.
Okay, over here we see sautéed watercress.
Yes, unusual. This is a classic Chinese dish. I first learned about it from my friend Grace Young, who writes wonderful Chinese cookbooks, and she talks about wok hei, which is when you get your wok so hot that the vegetable cooks very quickly, and then you're meant to eat it immediately to get that absolute delicious flavor of when the wok is hot enough. So here's the recipe. Little bit of cooking oil. I used canola, fresh ginger, and fresh garlic sautéed for 10 seconds. You throw in the watercress, young spring watercress, stem and all, and you cook it for maybe 3 minutes, tossing it till it's just tender. You add about a teaspoon or two of soy sauce. That's the whole dish. Couldn't be simpler. Eating that makes me feel energized in a calm way, the way a cup of coffee does. Like, I feel awake and alive and energized to move on with my day. In Chinese medicine, watercress is said to moisten the lung and help relieve a cough. And watercress is found throughout New England and many parts of the country by streams or rivers, thus its name, watercress.
But of course, farmers markets, and as you say, many supermarkets now just have all this for you. Boy, just a couple other thoughts for spring greens.
Other greens to look for: sorrel, which grows wild all around my garden. Many people also consider this a weed. If you taste it and it tastes like lemon, that's sorrel. You will find this in farmers market. It makes exceptional soup. You know, saute a leek or an onion, throw a ton of sorrel in, some vegetable stock, and whirl it up. You will have this gorgeous green spring soup. Also, you'll start to see spinach in the markets, but young. The thing about spring greens is that they're so tender, and you don't want to add a lot of fancy sauces or complex cooking techniques, because you really want to honor the greenness and the earth and the fact that we're back to a new season.
And not just in the nick of time. We've been talking spring greens with Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. Again, all these, it's beautiful and also tastes great. You will have it at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
Viruses are circulating above the atmosphere and falling from the sky like rain. It sounds like something out of a sci-fi or even a horror movie, but according to a recent study, it's real. Curtis Suttle is a biologist at the University of British Columbia and one of the study's authors. Professor Suttle, welcome, and explain that a little bit. Viruses falling from the sky, how'd they get up there?
So these viruses are largely swept up from the surface of the earth, either from the ocean or the deserts of North Africa, at least the ones that we were looking at. And they're swept high up into the atmosphere, what we would say is above the planetary boundary layer. So that's essentially in the area where air movements are not really impeded by the friction on the surface of the earth. So
a virus from the Sahara Desert could wind up in Topeka, Kansas?
Yes, at least in the east coast of North America without too much trouble. So, absolutely.
Is there scientific consensus on where these viruses are originating?
Yeah, we've got pretty clear signatures. So depending on the circulation of the winds and things like that, we can either tell that they're swept up off the ocean surface or that they're swept off of land, because the material that comes from the ocean looks quite different than the material that comes off the surface of the desert, for example.
So how did you and your team go about studying these wandering, free-floating viruses?
So my colleague from the University of Granada in Spain, Isabel Richet, who's the first author on the paper, she has these collectors that are high in the Sierra Nevada mountains of Spain. And she had been collecting this material in these collectors for some time, and we were just kind of asked the question, I wonder if there's any viruses in those, and if so, how many, and what are they doing, and how do they compare to, say, bacteria that are falling out of the sky, and things like that.
So not all viruses are harmful, correct? But in fact, many are beneficial to us.
Right. So many of the viruses, and perhaps just about all of them, in fact, are keeping planetary processes going on. So almost all of these viruses infect the microbes that are in the ocean and on the surface of the earth. So essentially, there are none of these microbes, statistically speaking, would infect humans. So it's not something we have to worry about.
So if humans are dependent on viruses, what are you learning so far about these buckets of free-floating, wandering viruses?
So I think the thing that's remarkable about it is it just shows how far they disperse. So about 10 years ago, we were puzzled by observations that we made, because we would find essentially the identical viruses in environments that were really, really different from each other. So we might find a virus and a meltwater pond in an Arctic ice shelf that seemed to be identical to another virus that was in the Gulf of Mexico, to another virus that was in a lake in Germany. And because viruses are so specific in terms of the organisms that they infect, well, there's really only two possibilities to explain that. Either the organism that they infected lived in all of these very, very different environments, which seemed really unlikely, or that somehow these viruses must be traveling vast distances and kind of falling down everywhere. And so I think these observations that we've made really support that conclusion, so that in fact these viruses are so widely dispersed. And so in microbial ecology, there's kind of a tenet that everything is everywhere, and the environment selects for those organisms that ultimately dominate that system. And I think this is the mechanism that allows these microbes to disperse around the planet.
Biologist Curtis Suttle, he's a professor at the University of British Columbia. Professor, thank you.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
And we're keeping an eye on Wall Street today. Stocks fell at this morning's open following the wild ride yesterday when the Dow closed down more than 400 points. Why the volatility? Well, how about the bond market? The yield on a 10-year Treasury note rose above 3% for the first time in 4 years. So maybe that is more attractive than stocks. Maggie Lake is here. She hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, good to talk to you.
Hi, Robin.
Good to talk to you. Now, we know there are many reasons the markets have been swinging lately, but what do these 10-year Treasury notes have to do with it? Tell us more about that.
Yeah, there's a couple of things going on. First of all, when you have higher yields, it tends to push up all borrowing costs and make everything more expensive, right? Remember, major banks benchmark their rates to government bonds. So we're going to see rates on everything from business loans to mortgages to credit cards start to go up. That's going to increase the cost of doing business and could cut into profits. And there's also concern that those higher rates could eventually slow the economy. Now, remember, stock investors aren't as concerned about what's happening right now. They really look 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road. And they're concerned about that as well. So put that together along with that sort of rotation question, and you've kind of got the perfect storm that's starting to hit stocks.
Well, we'll talk more about stocks and what happened yesterday. It was so volatile.
Yeah, you know, it really, we're sifting through earnings, but we keep coming back to the yield. We've been watching this happen, and 3%, it's not a magic number, but it's indicating that trends are changing, right? Until recently, you got paid almost nothing to keep your money in treasuries, and many investors felt they had no choice to be there. Now it's more of a conversation. Does it mean it's going to happen yesterday or today because that 10-year hit 3%? No. But if you're starting to get paid to put your money in bonds and treasuries, and especially if your risk appetite is more gauged that way, maybe you start to pull money out of stocks and put it there. So when you put all those things together, stock investors are looking at it. They're looking at a market price for perfection and saying, you know what? Maybe I'm going to take a little bit of money off the table. And that's why you keep seeing these sort of quick pops in the afternoon.
Well, I guess, I mean, was that what you were literally seeing? People pulling money from stocks and going into bonds? Because some were speculating it had to do with the Macron visit, the talk about the deal with Iran,
yes,
maybe being dismantled.
And I think that's part of it, because it also coincided with that. And this is what I say when I'm talking to traders, I'm talking to analysts. I said, you know, I hear a reason, and I hear that I know that reason is happening at 9 o'clock in the morning. It was happening at 12 o'clock. And then suddenly in the afternoon, we get this wave of selling. And what I hear again and again from all of them is that it's not just one of these things. It's all of them together, right? And you've had an unbelievable bull run. You've had huge profits coming in. It was a market that was priced for perfection. So when you look at them all together and you look 6 months out, you look a year out, do you feel that the reward justifies the risk? And there is a conversation that's starting to happen to say not so much. I also want to point out, Robin, you were talking about the Macron presser, and I think this is a perfect example. We have a lot of computer algorithms that are in play in the market. And when you see words together in a headline, 3% 10-year yield or Iran, horrible deal, you're going to trigger sell programs. Humans then step in, figure out whether they want to continue that, whether they want to believe it. But you do tend to get that sort of those big swings and that volatility. Mm-hmm. And I think the role of technology does have something to do with it as well.
Well, you mentioned some of the other factors. We got the report earlier this month from the Congressional Budget Office that the federal deficit will surpass $1 trillion in a couple of years, in part because of the Republican tax cuts. You've got earnings reports this week. So what are some of the other factors?
Yeah, I think that the spending bill and those huge deficits is something that we don't talk about all the time. It's not in the headlines, but it's going to be when you start seeing bond auctions like that. And again, it's not, you know, on the front page of a paper. It's not something that every average investor is looking at, but the market is. And that's a huge amount of debt to absorb. That's the supply side of the Treasury bond. You're going to start seeing the government have to pay higher yields in order to woo investors to get them to participate and absorb all of this debt. So that's going to be another factor that keeps those pressure on bond yields. Why does it matter to us? Because it's going to increase our cost of borrowing, whether you're a business or a consumer. So that is something that's going to increasingly play into it. And it's going to cross section with politics, right? There are a lot of Republicans or a lot of congressmen and women in Washington who are uncomfortable with these level of deficits. Mm-hmm. What do we do about that? So that is going to be an issue. And it's an issue for some of these CEOs who are talking about this on their call. Trade, another one. So, you know, you've got a lot of cross currents that investors are having to deal with. They're very unhappy about what they're hearing with trade.
Well, and one comment can send everything spiraling. Caterpillar started off well yesterday, higher than expected profits. But then the CFO, Brad Halvorsen, said in the earnings call, those numbers were a high watermark and shares tumbled and that snowballed across Wall Street.
That's right. And I think because the market is receptive to anything that is giving voice to the fear they have themselves, right, that the best is over. You know, it's interesting going into this earning period, a lot of people were wondering, do we hear more about that windfall, right, that big tax package that was so beneficial to companies? They were going to give back money in stock dividends and pay higher wages. Were we going to hear some more of that good news thread through? Remember, we did last earnings season. Instead, we're not. We're kind of hearing that the future is getting tougher. We're worried about whether earnings have peaked. We're worried about the cost of commodities rising. That's another theme that is coming up in this earnings season. We've seen oil rising. We've seen metal prices rising. Does that hit your cost? Companies have been really good about reining in costs. Does that start to eat into profits moving forward? That was certainly the case with Caterpillar.
Well, Maggie Lake telling us all we need to know about what happened yesterday as she hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Professional musicians like to play with their own familiar instruments, but in Nashville, members of the symphony there are gladly giving theirs up to perform around the city using the Violins of Hope. This is a collection of string instruments that survived the Holocaust. Emily Seiner from member station WPLN has this story.
Christy Seehafer has been playing the same violin for 26 years, so practicing for performance on a different one is challenging. The fingers on her left hand are dented with new calluses.
It's taking a lot more pressure to put the strings down, which is why my fingers look like this. But I'm sure that by the end of the week, I'll have it down. It'll tell me what it wants to do, and I'll do it.
Seehafer is a violinist with the Nashville Symphony. She's happy to work through the discomfort for this stunning showpiece.
It's got an inlaid Star of David on the back and some beautiful purfling here.
Small stripes that outline the front of the instrument. This is one of the Violins of Hope, found and restored by Israeli Avshi Weinstein and his family. Some belonged to Jewish musicians who fled Germany before the Holocaust. Weinstein says they were eager to get rid of anything German-made.
Some of them came to my grandfather and they said something very simple. They said, either you buy it from us, this violin, viola, cello, bow, whatever, or we are going to break it to pieces.
Other violins in the collection were played by prisoners in the concentration camps. He says Nazis would sometimes create orchestras, either to entertain themselves or to deceive newcomers.
There are stories about people who they arrived with the trains to a camp after a week or 2 weeks, squeezed in a cattle train with no food, no water, no air, and the first thing they would hear would be music. And they would think, okay, well, there is music here, so how bad can it be? And of course, they couldn't even imagine.
Weinstein and his father have taken the hallowed instruments on tour around the world. For their stop in Nashville, the symphony recently played a piece it commissioned for these violins. Jonathan Leshnoff is the composer. He had already been working on a series of symphonies exploring the themes of Jewish mysticism. The one that premiered in Nashville is called Hachelos, and it's a symphony in two parts.
The first part is a frenetic, kinetic rush with all the instruments quickly playing. And the second part is a very slow lyrical love song. To see these instruments that lived through such a dark period of human history, there's one violin which survived Auschwitz. And there it was, the concertmaster was playing it.
These instruments survived when so many people did not. And in a way, the musicians are bringing their stories back to life. Christy C. Hafer says the violin she selected to play from the collection has been dedicated to the memory of Jews massacred in pogroms in Poland. That gave her chills. C. Hafer's own uncle had been a Polish officer and was openly anti-Semitic, as she told Avshi Weinstein.
I just feel like I'm righting a wrong in so many ways. And the fact that I ended up with this, it's just, wow.
It's a small world.
Very small world.
By playing this violin, she says, she's giving voice to that history. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Seiner in Nashville.
Imagine entering a public bathroom stall and realizing it's missing something important, something like toilet paper. What do you do? You might rush out and buy your own roll, or more embarrassing, ask a stranger if they have any tissues to spare. It's not something men often think about, but this is how it could feel for a woman caught off guard by her period. Nancy Kramer is founder of Free the Tampon, a group that advocates to make menstrual products available in public areas for free. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you.
So your organization is trying to get feminine hygiene products to be freely available in locations outside the home. What turned you into an activist on this?
Well, the first time I saw menstrual support products freely accessible in a public restroom was when I went to Apple's corporate headquarters way back in 1982. And I just thought this was seemed like it made all the sense in the world. And I immediately instituted the policy in my own business. And I've been advocating for businesses and schools to do to follow suit ever since 1982.
If you're a woman and you unexpectedly begin getting your period in public and you don't have any pads or tampons on hand, how much can that interrupt your day at work? What are your options?
Well, it's devastating, frankly, and the consequences of not having access to the products are pretty humiliating and really a loss of dignity. I mean, you can, as we like to say, MacGyver your own solution with a bunch of toilet paper, but that's certainly not ideal. Women run the risk of having, you know, blood-stained clothing in an environment where that's just disrespectful and humiliating.
It can happen to a high school girl or a CEO of a Fortune 500 company.
Absolutely. And I've been, you know, many times going into a big meeting, I think sometimes stress will cause a woman to have an unexpected start to her period. And I found myself in that situation a number of different times in the workplace where it was like, oh my gosh, I just got my period and I'm getting ready to go do a big presentation. So not having what you need is absolutely humiliating.
But periods come regularly. How common is it to be caught off guard in public?
It can happen to anyone. I mean, we don't have any idea exactly when our periods are going to come. It's not like 2 o'clock on Tuesday, my period's going to come. Our bodies simply don't work that way. Yep. So As I said, stress or other factors, travel, for me, that was always something that really kind of messed me up. When the exact time is going to be, you don't know.
New York State moved recently to require schools to provide free feminine products, but you're talking about providing them for free in public places all over.
That's correct. So as part of my advocacy, I've been able to, for example, in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio, been able to advocate for the airport. For example, when you fly in and out of John Glenn International Airport, you'll have access to menstrual support products in all the restrooms. Same thing with our convention center. Same thing for our shelters. And we're working on the schools here. But one step at a time.
In your eyes, why are toilet paper, soap, and paper towels free and widely available and tampons aren't?
I think it's a lack of awareness. I also think that historically men made the decisions for those types of items. And in defense of men, there's nothing that their body does that's exactly like a period. So it's very difficult for a man to relate to. There's just nothing that's the equivalent. But I think that as we are having more awareness around this issue, we're seeing, you know, these states saying this isn't okay in schools. And I think next we'll see it more in the restrooms. And my goal is before I die to have changed the socially accepted norm on this issue.
What do you say to those who say, you know, why shouldn't this be a personal expense? I mean, everyone needs toilet paper, but not everyone needs menstrual products. I mean, is it fair to make everyone pay for them?
I think it is fair. I think it's a matter of what do we need to tend to our normal bodily functions? And menstruation is a normal bodily function that we have absolutely no control over. Again, I think that if men got periods, frankly, I don't think we'd be even having this discussion.
Today, are menstrual products available anywhere for free outside of some schools and some corporations?
There are businesses, there are restaurants, there are pockets of different places that you'll find them. I make a habit of every restroom that I go in to look and see. And once people start having awareness about this, they'll have the same reaction. They'll go into a restroom and see, wow, is this freely accessible here?
But it's not the majority. A long way to go still.
No, a long way to go. A really long way to go. And I really think it's a matter of changing what now has become a socially accepted rule, if you will. We don't expect people to walk around with rolls of toilet paper on them. I don't think we should expect people to walk around with tampons and pads on them.
Nancy, these products aren't free. How would you pay for this?
It's very affordable, and it needs to be incorporated into the operating budget of a business or school or institution or organization, just like toilet paper is. I found in our business, which is about 350 people, that the cost to us on an annual basis for every female that we have in our company is $4.67 a year.
Nancy Kramer is the founder of Free the Tampon, which works to make menstrual products available in public places for free. Nancy, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much, Eric.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Robin Young. That was eye-opening. It's Here and Now.